Welcome to episode 141 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all sorts of platforms, like the CBUS safety announcement system. My name is Mark Uessa, and I'm joined today by...
And my name is Daniel Winter. Hello, Mark.
Hello, how are you doing?
Excellent, thank you. Yes, we met up yesterday for a couple of little games. You managed to catch the CBUS for the first time in a while, I believe. Yeah, I got a trading card for the CBUS just a couple of days ago. I was out with my daughter, and one of the public transport attendants gave us these couple little trading cards, each representing one of the local public transport vehicles, which I thought was pretty fun.
Yeah, that's great. It was a real blast from the past. I grew up in North Vancouver, now I live in downtown or East Vancouver. So I used to take that all the time, every weekend, when I would visit the record shops on Granville Street back in the day. So this is nigh on, 30 plus years ago, perhaps, 30 years ago, around that. So that was a real nostalgic trip for me. And we got to hang out in Lower Lonsdale, which was also area which I knew very well, went through the Lonsdale Quay Market, which has changed quite a bit, but yes, some things have stayed the same.
Yep, nostalgia never changes.
Yeah, except for all the little things that do. So it was nice to visit there. And the board game cafe we visited was cool, but I'm sure we'll touch upon that a bit more later on.
Yeah, maybe a little later in our main course. But for now, we've got three courses of games to discuss, starting off with the appetizer. What have you got to serve up today, Mark?
Well, we're always trying to balance things out so that we're not just bad news all the time, because that seems to be what all news is all the time here. So I have a couple, one that I brought to your attention. I think you played a bit of Wanderstop last year, right?
Yes, I can't remember if I discussed it on the podcast, though.
Okay, well, I definitely didn't, but I seem to recall you mentioning it, so it's sad to see that. I believe the studio that created it, Ivy Road, has decided to close up shop. So they created Wanderstop, a game about essentially what the theme was, roughly about burnout and how to deal with that.
Largely, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and apparently they cited lack of funding for their new project. So it's unfortunate to see, but it happens sometimes with indie studios. And I don't know the full details, but it's unfortunate when, an indie studio making interesting games can't make it.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, even indies working at a different scale of proportions to the funding in AAA games are still struggling to get funding. With more beyond a couple of people who can support themselves, these are still quite expensive ventures that require large teams quite often, even for indie games and the growing budgets that people are coming to expect. So yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, I didn't love Wanderstop, but I know a lot of people who absolutely did, and I admire what they were trying to achieve with that game at the very least. So yeah, a shame to see that their latest project couldn't get off the ground.
Yeah, and another piece of news isn't entirely negative. It's more like a question out there. But I was listening to what I thought was a recent episode of another podcast, but it wasn't at all. It's from the December. I was listening to an episode.
I'm still catching up my December podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always months behind,
yeah,
which is shameful, I guess, as a podcast host. But I was listening to the Besties episode 477 from December, and they were talking about Metroid Prime 4, and they had some thoughts about that. I haven't played it myself, so I don't have any opinions to compare it to. But the theme of the episode kind of like delved into another one, which is like, really, what is the Nintendo Switch 2 for? Is it really serving any purpose? Nothing that Nintendo has really put out on that platform has really set the world on fire, especially the very few platform exclusives to the Nintendo Switch 2. Of course, there's all the Nintendo Switch 1 games that look much better and run much better. But, it's a bit of an indictment to say that finally the games run well on this secondary platform when it should have run well on all platforms. So I thought that was an interesting topic. I kind of feel the same way, as like, I don't know why I bought this thing, except that it will probably be more expensive in the future, and that down the road, hasn't happened yet, there'll be incomparable Nintendo branded game that we can't live without. Maybe it's the next Animal Crossing. I don't know what it is, but it's not here yet.
Well, some people are saying that Pokopia is the must-have game. And I am playing Pokopia and having a blast, I will say. I'm not going to do a full review just yet, but that one's been quite enjoyable. And, I mean, my daughter has been playing... I mean, she's been playing Pokemon Violet, I guess, which was also available on the Switch 1, but is actually running smoothly now on the Switch 2. Yeah, I mean, as someone without a Steam Deck, there's obviously a lot of appeal just to having portable games, and I've been defaulting to the Nintendo as my... That's basically my default platform now. I mean, I have a Steam library, but it's only a certain type of game that I really want to be on the computer playing, sort of leaning forward. Like, most of the time, you want to be sitting back on the couch with a handheld, right? So Nintendo has been very convenient for that as a default for playing indies like Mio that I discussed a few weeks back.
Right. That listening to that episode of Besties, it just made me think that really the Nintendo Switch 2 hasn't been a revolutionary step forward for games. I do happen to play a lot of my smaller indie games recently on the Switch Lite, which I like quite a bit more for the form factor. It reminds me of the PS Vita, which is one of my favorite devices for that kind of widescreen, smaller platform. It just is highly portable, has a nice feel, but plays, you know, like real games. Mm. But what feels more revolutionary now, which not many people are talking about, is how you can play Steam PC games on the Android platform using these secondary kind of middleware softwares like Game Native or Game Hub. And, you know, I've extolled on the virtues of the Retroid Pocket 5, which is like a, you know, a 2-year-old system, but I can play so many of my Switch library smaller indie games on that, and I haven't been able to even test all the games that I want to try on it, but the ones that I have really impressed me. You know, I can play like Megabonk, which I bought on Steam. You know, not a system, you know, it's not a game that's going to break a typical PC down to its knees or anything like that, but just the fact that I can play some of my later Steam games on that relatively inexpensive platform is, to me, more revolutionary, more fundamentally game-changing in my day-to-day life than the new Nintendo Switch platform, because it unlocks like this vast library of older, smaller, controller-friendly indie games that are generally cheaper and go on sale more frequently than anything on Nintendo Switch.
I know you also like to tinker, and I think there's still a lot to be said about you know, the plug and play ease of use in the consoles, like your Xbox and your PlayStation and your Nintendo. Like, even compared to something like the Retroid Pocket, which I don't have, but like my little AmberNIC device, I found like quite tricky to navigate. They're not intuitive to use in the vanilla software, and there's not a lot of accountability in terms of like software breakdown, which I've heard anecdotally a lot of stories of with some of those devices. So I think it's still like that prestige of Nintendo that you know what you're getting. There's more accountability there, but also just the ease of use, the plug and play nature.
Yeah, plug and play and ease of use is sort of like the flip of the coin of the closed platform, right? So the platform has greater control. They can restrict things. People can optimize their games to run on closed systems really well. Although they have failed to do that on Switch 1, in my opinion. Even Nintendo first-party games have failed to do that. They've released straight-up first-party games that do not run adequately on their first-party platform. So I think that's a failure. Ease of use, great, but is it a good experience? I think you have to counter that. And I'll just say that apps like Game Native are not that much more difficult to configure than apps that you download from a first-party platform.
I know, it's intimidating to me, to be honest.
No, you just go to a website instead of an official store like the Play Store to download an app. Not that hard. So I'll expand upon that in the future. I'm just thinking it just makes kind of crystallized. That conversation kind of crystallized something that I was thinking of all this time. Maybe I'll get back into PC games again if I can play more of them on a smaller platform like the Retroid Pocket 5.
And I had also been keeping an eye out for that Steam box, Steam Cube, whatever that was called. Unfortunately, you know, with the nature of RAM and computer prices right now, I don't know how likely it's going to be that there's going to be that how available they're going to be and or expensive, I guess.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
I mean, Valve promised that they would make an announcement by first quarter of this year, and it's obviously the first quarter or into the second.
2 days.
They haven't yet. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, it's don't hold your breath for that announcement. Yeah. Anyways, how about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I had a few things to talk about, but in the interest of saving some time for games we've been playing, just a couple of quick updates. A demo that I played recently that hadn't discussed in the podcast, but has now been fully released, a little game called The Wide Open Sky is Running Out of Catfish. So a bit of a mouthful of a name there, but I quite enjoyed that demo. It's quite a small indie game, it's very like lo-fi, vaporwave aesthetics. You live on the back of this giant flying catfish, and you're basically manipulating the world to release other fish into the sky and taking photos. So it's a very like Pokemon Snap-ish sort of game, taking photos. There's a computer interface in your house that you're like chatting to friends along the way, and like there is like some narrative story about why you're up here and what you're doing, and I found that quite compelling. Just because you're talking on this, my point of reference would be something like MSN Messenger. It's probably another like an ICQ analog or something like that, but I found it quite nostalgic in that regard. Not just the interface, but the language. It feels like very coded to my personal nostalgia. It feels a little bit like some of the, not quite Adventure Time, but like the pre-Adventure Time, like early 2000s Cartoon Network sort of quirky vibe before they doubled down that like really random stuff, but just a little wacky. I know, just keys into a really specific moment of nostalgia for me. So I found that quite enjoyable. Looking forward to checking out the full game.
Very nice. Anything else new on your plate?
Yes, one more quickly. That there's been a new game announcement. That is The Lord of the Rings, The King's Gambit. So this is coming out in collaboration with Restoration Games and Space Cowboys. Basically, it's a reimagining of The Queen's Gambit, the Phantom Menace adaptation. It was, I don't know what year that would have come out, but early 2000s, I guess, again. But basically, it was like a giant cardboard cube, I think, but you were fighting, it was like a miniatures game where you're fighting on multiple battlefronts, like you're fighting in space and on the ground simultaneously. And this is obviously going to be translating that to The Lord of the Rings, where you've got multiple battlefields occurring simultaneously, both large scale and small scale. Like you might have the Battle of Minas Tirith happening, and then you got the Frodo and Sam trying to get to the mountain. And I think there's already some games have captured some of that, like War of the Ring to an extent, even Lord of the Rings Duel that we discussed previously, is sort of abstracting those two different scales of conflict, I guess. So I think it's easy to be very cynical about the number of Lord of the Rings games coming out, I say with a stack of them behind me here. I do think that theme does fit quite nicely to that mechanic. Not that I've played the original game, but I like the idea of the different scales of battlefields that's contrasting there.
So yeah, I'm not as intimately familiar with the subject matter of The Lord of the Rings, like the story, as closely as you. I've seen the first trilogy of movies, and I've forgotten more than I remember of what goes on. But yeah, you're right. You know, I like stories where multiple threads of things are going on, and then you have the nail-biting moment of seeing if all the different pieces will fall in line, and that seems to fit well with what the Queen's Gambit was initially trying to do. So, yet to see how this will turn out, but, you know, I'll definitely try it out if it's a good-looking product.
Well, I've always said Lord of the Rings is my personal Star Wars. I'm reading the Lord of the Rings books again right now, hashtag Lord of the Year. I'm very much primed right now to be appreciating this sort of thing, so looking forward to that.
Isn't it hashtag Year of the Lord?
I think I said it incorrectly last week. It's Lord of the Year.
Okay, interesting. Well, you'll be happy to know that I've loaded up The Hobbit on my new Kobo device, so I'll be reading through that on your prodding. All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we move into our main topic?
Yeah, lots to talk about. Let's jump to it.
Yeah. Are we going to talk about the place that we visited yesterday?
I think so. I think we should. Yeah.
Let's do it.
We played some games together.
All right. So this was your recommendation. So why don't you tell us about, you know, where it is and what it's all about?
Yeah. I mean, it's about a year old now, a board game cafe called Mensch Cafe in North Vancouver, which I've been meaning to check out for a while. Hadn't quite gotten around to it, but I saw they had a booth at Terminal City Tabletop Convention. And you and I didn't really get to play any games together there, and we're looking to catch up. So I thought that was a nice excuse to go and check that out. So it was a pretty cozy space. It's a bit sort of hidden away in this labyrinthine building, but quite spacious when you get inside. And it had, it's a board game lounge, but also a computer lounge in the back as well. They have a bunch of gaming PCs and a big TV for console gaming. So they've got a pretty broad range of games. They're an omni-gaming lounge, I guess you could say. But yeah, quite a nice, cozy board game space there as well, with library and a few fairly basic cafe offerings. But yeah, we quite enjoyed our time there, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the place definitely looks attractive. There's board game themed artwork and decoration on the wall, like this life-size snakes and ladders, chutes and ladders kind of set up on the wall. I would say life-size. The ladders are life-size. I don't know about the snakes. Depends on the breed, I suppose. And then the PC gaming area is very moody with it's much darker with neon artwork, and they've got the PC cases on the wall, and the interior kind of LED lighting of them and kind of acts like wall art and mood art. I think there was a bust of Jesus Christ in faux neon holding a rifle.
Didn't actually see that.
Above the large screen television in front of a couch. So that was playing, I think it was playing Mortal Kombat through most of the time that we were playing.
What Jesus do? Play Mortal Kombat, apparently.
There you go. But yeah, it was a cool space. And when we showed up, we were the second party in there. And the first one was just a group of young kids.
There's a bunch of tweens. I guess had been dumped there for the day on the spring break. And they were having a great time.
Probably. I mean, the way it seems to work for us was we took advantage of the all-day plan, which is just you pay $10 Canadian. And you can play until, he said, 2 a.m. or something.
Yeah, they're
like
open
that.
Very late. Yeah.
And we showed up at around 2 p.m. So that was 12 hours of entertainment for $10. Pretty cheap, I suppose. And then we were there for 2 or 3 hours, I guess. And eventually, many more groups of people came. There seemed to might have even been a birthday party there, a couple of double dates, and then larger groups of 6 or so. So there's plenty of space. And it seemed quite lively. By the time we ended up leaving around closer to 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. Their catalog of games is interesting. It's mostly on the casual side.
Oh, traditional games as well.
Traditional games. The tables were set up with things like poker and Ludo and chess boards, backgammon, and that sort of stuff typically. But of course, you can clear those tables off and put your own games there. There were some newer games, some more niche gamer games.
Still in shrink, in fact.
Yeah, for sure. There were some local games, Canadian design games. And then there were some more serious ones, there was Power Grid and Brass Birmingham and that sort of stuff. If you are a serious core gamer, you may wish to bring some titles yourself, because it wasn't a massive library, and a lot of them were oriented towards those more traditional games. A lot of the game boxes had Middle Eastern writing on them, some Farsi. I happen to know, having grown up in North Van, that there's a very large Persian-Iranian community there.
And it is a Persian-run cafe, I should say.
Yeah, especially in Lower Lonsdale area, lots of businesses are Persian-oriented. And some of the menu leans towards that direction. There was some mixed nuts and seeds.
Baklava.
There was Turkish coffee, which I ordered. Baklava and other treats, along with French fries and other traditional things. So seemed like a good balance of stuff. You want to talk about the games we played?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we did a smattering of games. The first one we tried out was, what is that publisher that...
Game Rights.
Game Right. Yeah, they make a lot of kind of more youth-oriented games. Although some of them are more serious, like Matt Leacock ones.
Forbidden Island, one of my favorite games.
There you go. The one we played from them was a smaller card game called Dragonwood. Mm-hmm. Neither of us had tried it, but you expressed some interest in the theme.
I was basically looking to check it out for my daughter, who's very much into dragons right now.
Yeah, and it was a pretty simple game. I don't know for how many players it was, but we obviously played it with two. And it was a very simple concept. There was like three ways you could attack a range of enemy cards. You know, thematically, it's very much like Thunderstone or that sort of like attack the monsters kind of a game. And you had cards that you drew into your hands of potential, I guess,
different types of heroes, basically, yeah.
Right? And there were three types of attacks. I don't remember the names, but there were like stomp and slash and...
Slash, stomp and scream, I think it was.
Sure. And basically, it was like you either presented a run of cards or a mat, like one, you know, five, six, seven.
Yeah.
Or a set of matching cards, so all sixes. Or what was the third one?
Matching
colors. All the same color.
Yeah.
Right, because they
basically
were
basically forming poker hands of varying sizes.
Yeah. And confusingly, we thought that, or I thought initially, that you were supposed to target the cumulative number of the cards added together. But no, each of the cards in your set represents a die you could roll. And there was like six D6s or whatever in the box. And if you presented three cards, then you can roll three D6, add up their total. And if you beat the difficulty for that type of attack, you get to claim the card and you get the victory points associated with it. Pretty straightforward, kind of a little dull, to be honest, in its basic form. But there were these sort of equipment, I guess you could say, helper things.
Right, like engine building,
magical spells.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, so light engine building elements. And I thought that that was mildly interesting. So I guess you're making like a... sacrifice is like, do you want to stop collecting points so that you can gain these tools that may help you be more efficient at collecting points?
I mean, having played a lot of kids games lately, I think I'm a little more lenient towards these light games. I can see the appeal for family groups, obviously. It's basically an introduction to forming poker hands with a more thematic touch and a bit of push your luck there as well. And it's also got that sort of Mad Libs of like, oh, I'm going to stomp on the giant spider. I'm going to scream at the orange dragon. And like that almost, Arabian Nights, that sort of, I'm going to X the Y sort of role-playing aspect of it.
Yeah, I guess for me, like the reason why I wasn't so keen on it was basically the very tired theme of it and the very kind of basic by the numbers sort of
fantasy
art and application of it. There are many card games of light games that are accessible to younger people that are much more interesting, mechanically speaking, you know, games like My First Bonanza or something like that, or even just straight up good card games like Lost Cities or whatever are just as easy to understand by younger people and are just infinitely more interesting mechanically and thematically. Well, except for Lost Cities. Lost Cities has no theme. It doesn't really matter what the theme is.
Yeah. Well, this is a 10-year-old game now anyway as well. So I know that a theme has been done better. I probably wouldn't be reaching for it myself, but if it's a thing that gets your kid interested, then yeah, I think it's a perfectly fine game.
Well, as we'll learn, it doesn't matter how old the game is. It could still be a winner, even if it's an old one. But we'll get to that. You had a couple of newer games that you brought with you, right?
Yeah, so I, at TCTC, had picked up in the used marketplace a couple of games I'd been on the hunt for, and that is the latest duology from Rainer Knizia and Bitewing Games is the publisher. I think it's the Ancient Games series or something like that. It's Ikor and Iliad, these two different games that are both two-player abstracts. Basically, both by Rainer Knizia.
Yeah, and we did Ikor first, and it's a very like simple grid-based game where we have a symmetrical type of units in a blind bag, and we're pulling out like two of them at a time.
That's Iliad that you're thinking of, yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Oh. The names are very similar. So.
Yeah, I thought... Oh, I guess it was the Trojans versus the Persians or whatever,
yes,
in that one.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. That was the Iliad first... You know, thematically, it's fine. The artwork is quite nice. It's appropriate. So no knocks there. Both of the games, actually, the artwork looks pretty similar. I thought in one of the other games, Ikor, some of the contrast got lost a little bit.
Yeah, the artwork is better than the graphic design, I will say.
Yeah, actually, in both of them, I thought the graphic design could have used some improvements. Mm. For instance, there were these little tiles in Iliad which are essentially forming the amount of points you would score. And I really couldn't even tell which god each of the tiles
was representing. The colors were quite similar, weren't they? Because you have to collect these sets of five different god tiles.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out, oh, which one do I have and do I not? And trying to having to scan the colors. It's a little fiddly. Yeah.
Yeah, colors itself is not enough to differentiate between cards, obviously, because of color blindness and other, you know, color representation. But they could have had a very clear, high contrast icon to represent the different gods, because obviously it's been done so many times before. But they had these kind of like abstract illustrations, and they were hard to read at a distance.
Yeah.
So that could have been better. Gameplay wise, I thought it was fine, cool. There were a limited type of units. I think they just ranged between like 1 and 5, right?
Basically, yeah. But each one of those numbers also had a special ability to manipulate the board or move pieces around in a certain way.
Yeah, and one of them was non-numbered, and it kind of like you stole the power of those opposing enemies. Yeah. So I thought that was quite cool. I mean, if I knew the pieces better and I knew the relative distribution of them, I would have played differently, of course. That said, not knocking that just because I didn't win the first time. But I feel like it's a game that you want to play a few times, get a sense for, and then, I don't know, I guess the variety comes from you versus the opponent rather than, I don't know, the scenario or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, just about every two-player abstract game is going to... It's very hard to give initial impressions from a single game because you don't get the full arc of what the strategy is going to be until you've seen one game, and that's constantly going to be evolving. So generally, you want to be playing these multiple times. But some of those are going to reward multiple playthroughs better than others, perhaps.
Right. So moving on to the next game, iCore. That one was more gameplay space, I guess you would say. So each time we were playing the gods versus the monsters, I guess it was. And they're essentially symmetrical. There seems to be some variance between them, but some shared powers across the different styles. And you choose 6 gods or 6 monsters any given round, I guess. And you move these pieces chess-like across your board. You can move straight orthogonally, so straight or sideways.
They all basically move like rooks in chess.
In any distance until you reach either an opposing monster or god. But if you... And you're dropping along these like little influence tokens for every step that you pass across.
It's like reverse Pac-Man, sort of dropping things behind you.
Yeah, you drop these little poops behind you. And if you cross an opposing one, you basically replace it with your own color. And the round ends when the first player has used up all of their pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And you score...
There was a UFO 50 game called Paint Chase. I just clicked. That was quite a similar... Or Splatoon, basically, where you're trying to paint the board in your color more than the other opponent, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And you score the number of points equal to the number of pucks that are left in the opponent's inventory. So very simple to understand. I was trying to get into the headspace of knowing what my monsters did or knowing what my gods did. There were 6 of them, and each of the powers varied quite a bit. And when you used a power, effectively, it's only one use per game. So when you used an ability, you flip the card over, you can't use it anymore. And some of the cards even say, and then remove this monster from the board, or remove an opposing god and a monster, or something like that. So they were interesting. I found that in both of the rounds we played of that, well, you won both cases. I guess the first time around, I wasn't really paying attention to the fact that the round ended when you use up your pieces.
It can end very quickly, yeah.
it was a very short, right? Like 10 minutes maybe per round, about that. So I was just kind of like blown away by that, because I guess I was just like trying to read into the powers deeper than I should have. And in pretty much every case, neither of us utilized all of our god's powers.
Yeah, or like the monsters felt much more useful. The gods were all very situational. The gods' abilities were hardly used at all when either of us were playing as the gods, I felt. The monsters definitely felt more broadly useful.
Yeah, so you'll probably use maybe like two or three of the given powers. And I thought, like, that's where my kind of complaining came in, is that I, like, prefer, if I'm going to play a two-player abstract game, I prefer games that have very simple sets of rules, like chess or Go, where everything's sort of spelled out and the, you know, the interesting situations kind of rise through permutations of those basic rules. Whereas it felt like sort of a waste to have those six powers when most of them are not going to apply for the short round, and you're only really going to utilize two or three of them if you're lucky enough to find a situation in which they're useful. So I ended up expending a lot of brain power trying to find situations where it could be advantageous, and I should have just been using the basic ability of going straight and putting down tokens.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle with these sort of games instead of thinking more than one turn ahead. So I was very, very much just taking it moment by moment, and then still managed to win for what it's worth. But I'm sure it is a game that you could lean into that more advanced play, but it's going to take a few games to recognize the different abilities and how they interact, because every time you play, it's going to be different abilities.
You know, any game that has special abilities, you want to use those special abilities, right? Like, that's the point. That's why they're cool. So a game that intentionally doesn't really, that is over before you get to even use half of them, feels kind of like a disappointment or a missed opportunity. Anyways, that's just my hot take on that after one game experience.
Yeah, I think I can definitely see the appeal. I did really like that core mechanic of the plopping the units down. Sorry, the tokens, like the painting the board in your color, I thought is quite compelling mechanic. But it was a few too many other pieces that were a bit of a distraction, I guess. So maybe you wanted a simplified version, and maybe you could, I don't know, like a legacy version maybe might be a bit too much, but like seeing a sense of progression, gradually adding on more of those powers rather than getting distracted by them for the first game and just focusing on a core movement might have been a little more compelling.
Right, and also built into the game is a sort of expanded mode. We did play on the smaller board, which is like a 6x6 grid, I believe. And the expanded one, if you flip the, you know, attractive-looking cloth mat, is a 7x7 grid, and presumably you'd be using seven gods and seven monsters, which would maybe, it will certainly expand your options, but maybe extend the gameplay time as well. Because you'd be putting down more additional pucks as well.
Yes, yeah, you've got a lot more tokens to get on the board for the win state. But yeah, I'm curious to see how that plays. There are some expansions to add new abilities and things as well. But I wouldn't really need that at this point. I'm still quite interested in the simplified version of it. But I mean, all this got you talking about some. We were talking about, you know, two player abstract games and their appeals, and led you to suggest a much older one of those.
Right. I was surprised actually when I mentioned Othello. Or sometimes called Reversi, that you said you hadn't played it before. And I guess this is my bias showing up, is that like I kind of assume that everyone grew up playing Othello. For some reason, it's very, very popular in Japan, even though we discovered it's not a Japanese designer. But pretty much every home in Japan has an Othello board, and kids typically play it in the way that other North American kids play checkers, perhaps. But Othello is a very basic game. We did find a copy, a Persian copy at the Mensch's, and set it up. It was in a disc. It was had a board that had like these disconcerting little like divots, and the pieces were sort of like disc, ovoid shapes that were, of course, half black and half white. I'm used to the nice velvet board the felt board that has the flat discs that you satisfyingly slap down. But that's just me.
It's not quite satisfying to actually flip them. Maybe plucking them down is more satisfying when they're flat.
Yeah, flipping them
was pretty cool here.
My problem is that putting them down is fine, but they would wobble and then they wouldn't sit flat. That's my problem. Anyways, I'm not going to explain Othello to you. Just go look it up, or most of you have probably played it before. But I thought there was interesting similarities to the previous two games that we played. Pretty much the starting setup is the same as in the Iliad. You start in the center 2x2 squares, and you have angle of two of one color and then two of the other colors.
Yeah.
An alternating arrangement, and you start out from there. And of course, Othello starts up very relaxed in the center. Nothing really matters. It's very easy breezy.
I take one of yours, you take turns. One of mine.
Yeah. And that's the cool thing about that game is that it literally flips. This gameplay situation flips every turn. Drastic changes can be made, especially near the end of the game. And I really enjoyed playing that game. It had been years. I taught you without having read the rules, because I can't read Persian. But I think I remembered most of them. Interesting situation came up where you tried to put a piece down and you didn't flip any pieces. Like you were putting a piece down at kind of the edge of the board.
To try and set up for a future turn. Yeah. Yeah.
And when I looked it up online, it looked like you did have to... What do they call it? Flank?
You have to capture.
You have to capture. Yeah. I guess that's built into the rules. I hadn't ever experienced that, of not someone not trying to capture the pieces. Anyways, that game has a nice arc to it. It starts simple and light and mild. And then as you approach the edges of the board, the tension sort of ratchets up. There's fewer spaces to place things. And the moves, each move can have a much larger impact because you can span the entire length of the board all in one go. I thought it had a nice increase in the tension, and it met with my initial preference, which was I like to see the board state very clearly. It has very few rules, easy to understand, but hard to master is the typical phrase. I don't know. What did you think about your first experience with Othello?
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed that. Fates can change very quickly. It looks like the board is mostly black, but the more you have on the board, the more you have to lose, basically. So it's a bit of a, not, I don't know if it's necessarily a handicap, but it does balance back and forth like a seesaw in some quite satisfying ways until you get to the edges and can really start locking down some sort of longer term strategies. And that sort of, the strategy shifts entirely once you hit the edges and can start maneuvering some different types of positioning. I really enjoyed that. I'd seen a few like Pokemon versions floating around that I've been looking to get for my kid perhaps sometime. I'm not sure if she's quite ready for the strategy of it. But it's quite a satisfying game, just the flipping things and seeing it evolve dynamically at the board state.
Yeah, and what I really liked about that and why I felt satisfying having played it after so many years of not playing it is that the game is really tense right up until the end. Like, it really boils down to the last two turns. It could be anyone's game. And even when we ended up pretty close to each other's score. So that level of kind of tension was enjoyable. And another thing I liked about it, which it shared with, I guess, the previous two games, or certainly with Ikor more, is that you can have interesting plays where you play offensively and defensively at the same time. Mm-hmm. You have to think about where you leave openings for the other player to attack you and try and mitigate those as much as possible. So, you know, good qualities in a game.
I do wonder if over multiple playthroughs it would start to feel like that the first half of the game is a little bit arbitrary, just back and forth and back and forth. And I don't know how much that actually has an impact on the end game state, or if it's just or preamble and sort of warm up to what the game is going to become.
It could, but of course, people that play a game very often can also like speed through the fast part, right? It can go like clack, 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 clack. As you slap the pieces down, and then that arc levels out as things get a little bit more intense, and then the moves are more meaningful nearer to the end of the game, which has, like I said, like a nice arc, a nice feel to it. I like a game that isn't flat, right? Isn't the same thing every single turn.
Yeah, definitely an arc to this one, yeah.
Anyways, those are the games we played at Mench's. We had fun and could have played more. But, it seems, I would say, mostly classic games there. Not a lot in the way of the more intense gamer games. But there were some in the kind of the middleweight, like, family-friendly variety as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm generally happy to bring along some of my own collection anyway. And, sorry, the cat is really hassling me today. What is with you?
Wants to get in the action.
Uh-huh.
All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we move on to other games that we played, or...
Yes, yeah. Why don't you tell us about what you've been playing?
Sure, yeah. I'll try and go through this quickly because I feel like we've talked at length about Mench's there. I've been playing a video game over the past few weeks, actually, and kind of just trying to fit this in between other games. and is sort of a continuation of our Metroidvania era, I guess, that we've been having for the past few episodes. So this game is sort of a Metroidvania game, but not entirely so. It's not another one to add to the list. This game is called The Night Witch, and it's from 2002. It's published by Team 17, makers of, you know, games like the Worms series. And it's developed by a studio I haven't heard of before, Super Mega Team. And this game is quite delightful to look at. The artwork is beautiful, kind of has this like anime sort of chibi style to it. Very colorful, very sort of whimsical storybook setting. The setting is a little intense, actually. It's a kind of a post-apocalyptic. The world is coming to an end because there's like steampunk kind of clinker units, but there's these magical night witches, a team of four superpowered ladies who kind of defend the people, and they sacrifice their lives against the evil enemy. They defeat the enemy, but the people have to set themselves away in this underground kind of bunker. And the game has moved on. People have moved on after the Night Witch's sacrifice. And this one character, the protagonist, I believe her name is Reyna, is a sort of like Night Witch in training. She never got to see the fighting forces. She was, the war ended before she got her chance. But obviously, you think everything's fine, and then this new force is coming to shake things up. So you play as Reyna, the protagonist, a fledgling Night Witch. And like other Metroidvanias, you start sort of weak, and you grow stronger. Night Witches, unlike Castlevania or other platformers like Metroid, this game is not a platformer. It's a you can fly. It is side-scrolling 2D, so it is like them in that way. But you can fly, you know, up, down, left, right, in any direction that you want to. You don't fly that fast, so you're not really, you know, dodging. Well, you are dodging some stuff, but that'll come later. You're not platforming is the main thing, because this game is also a bullet hell shooter. And that's what makes it very distinctly different from those other Metroidvanias. So the Night Witch has a basic sort of pea shooter, but she also has a number of car spells at her disposal. And wouldn't you know it, we're adding another game genre to the mix. This game is also a deck builder. So you draft a deck of six cards, spell cards, and the makeup is up to you. And you only ever have a hand of three spell cards at a time. And you pick up energy orbs at healing stations and some monsters that you defeat, and some environmental elements will replenish your energy orbs. So you can't just freely blast off your spell cards, or if you do, you might find that you're lacking in additional energy for quite some time.
So are the cards just like ultimate weapons that you can one use between health stations or something? Or like,
No, they aren't. Every time, you always have a hand of three spell cards, but you don't always have three energy points.
Okay.
Right. So basically you get dealt a hand of three energy cards, spell cards. You have three energy. You can blast them off at any point, but those energy won't get replenished immediately.
So but they only get replenished at health stations. So basically you can get
yes at health stations, but enemies also drop them.
Do you get new cards in between as well?
Yeah, you do. You get new cards at kind of fixed points, so you get new cards definitely when you finish story missions, and also when you satisfy side missions.
So you mean like drawing new cards of those three in your hand?
You automatically draw up to three cards at all times.
Okay.
So you always have three cards.
All right.
But you don't know what cards you're going to get. So that is where some of the deck building comes into play, is that each of the spells has a energy cost. And that can range from low to high, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. And interestingly enough, you only start with 3 energy. So you might be collecting high-powered ones that you can't even utilize. And it's up to you to determine whether you want sort of lighter, sort of weaker spells, or a few stronger spells, or a balance of them in between. So this game gives you a lot of flexibility and a lot of control in how your loadout is going to be. So I think that's really cool in comparison to some more static Metroidvania games that we've covered in the past.
How does that, like, you're playing in real time. Like, is it distracting to try and read what cards you have while dodging bullets?
It is a little bit at first. I think you were talking about twin stick shooters the other day, and I was saying, oh, I wish this game was a twin stick shooter. And it's not. You have to manually aim, which I suppose you do in a twin stick shooter as well. But you have to hold the, I think it's the right trigger to shoot your pea shooter. And then you choose one of three face buttons to be your spells. And that part of it is not too bad. It's sort of like playing an MMO, right? When you play an MMO, there's a bar of a bunch of hotkeys, right? And the hotkeys, they have very complex powers associated with them. Or you might be Diablo as well. But eventually you get to learn, oh, that icon is that thing. That's my favorite go-to for close quarters combat, right? So you get to familiarize yourself with the icon, and you know when that comes up, oh, okay, that's ready to go. I'll blast it off. And then right after that, while I blast off this kind of defensive spell, I'll shoot off this offensive one, and then I'll do a 1-2 combo, and that'll give me just enough energy left to blast off the third spell or whatever.
Seems like it'd probably be a bit of a delay regardless, like in trying to process that information and execute it, I guess, as opposed to the immediacy of a regular twin stick shooter. Because I've been playing another Metroidvania called Mini Shoot Adventures, which is basically a twin stick shooter Metroidvania. And it's exactly what it says in the box, basically. I don't know what I expected. It's that, exactly.
Yeah, not having played that game, won't know how to compare the two. But you're right in that you do have to stay on your toes. You literally don't know what cards you're going to get dealt after every healing station. And sometimes you get a good hand and sometimes you don't. But with three cards, you know, you'll just blast one off just to clear it up and draw some more cards. And that's part of the fun and part of the challenge. But they definitely have an effect. I haven't really talked about what else is going on here. You traverse the environment a lot. Periodically, you run into these ambush situations, which are actually quite cool. In some of the map areas, you might even have a largish area, but they will wall off areas where there's no escape, and you have to face a handful of enemies, and then they're coming at you rapid fire, and they're coming at you from all directions. So everything is coming at you from all directions. You don't have a lot of time to think. Sometimes you can get into real luck with the cards that you draw. Just the perfect arrangement of them come up. You manage to snag more energy orbs to replenish your energy so you can blast off more spells. There's a give and take. It really works as a good flow there. But some runs you will just fail because you don't get dealt the right cards. But is that your fault for not choosing the right cards?
Yeah.
Or is it the luck of the draw? It's a little bit of both, right? The spells are actually really cool in that it gives you a lot of agency in setting up how your player, Reyna, plays. Although I found that I was kind of relying on basically two basic types of cards that you get really early on. Those being the homing attacks, of which there's a light one or a triple homing attack, which costs more, obviously. And then the shield ability, which is kind of like a radial blast around you that neutralizes bullets, because this is a bullet hell. You're going to be facing a lot of bullets. And in addition to these ambushes, there are lots of bosses and mini bosses that add additional challenge. They are satisfying. They are not as quite as epic as some of the Castlevania bosses that we've encountered pretty recently, but they are still satisfying and they are still challenging. And like I said, it really depends on the cards that you bring. If you have a run and you die at the mini boss, you can rearrange your deck, which is really, really cool. It kind of keeps you on your toes. It makes you adapt. It gives you power to choose the ability that you think will be effective. And if you line up your cards right, then you will have a successful run. I haven't had any situation where I'm not able to beat a boss after, you know, 4 or 5 attempts. So it's a good amount of challenge, but not that hard. So that's really cool. This game also is an RPG, so it will allow you to collect what they call link power. So this is kind of cool. Night witches gain their power from how much belief that the people have in them. So obviously the four original night witches are like superstars. Like, everyone loves them. They have celebrations and holidays to honor them. And you're just this kind of like fledgling, so nobody knows who you are. But as you go on and you rescue more people, you complete more missions, more people know who you are. They gain faith in you. They become your fans.
That's a feedback loop. Okay.
Yeah. And then your link effect level, which is represented by this chain link, grows. And then that gives you power-ups, level-ups. And each time you level up, you get to choose whether to power up your, I think it's your body or your mind. And the body powers up your basic abilities, your health, essentially. Maybe it's your shooting fire rate of your basic pea shooter. Maybe it's the effectiveness, the damage dealt by your regular pea shooter. So that's your body. And then the other option is your mind. And it changes how effective your spell cards are. So another way that this game really lets you customize and make the way your character plays your own. I don't think Castlevania Symphony of the Night really let you customize the way you played so much as this does, other than equipping a weapon or something like that.
You still have to like do a little bit of both, though, I imagine. You can't like just focus on the spells or just the pea shooter.
Yeah, I mean, I've upgraded like 5 or 6 times at this point, and I've done more of one. I think I did more of spells and then a little bit more of body nowadays, more recently. So, just the fact that it gives you a choice is really nice. And then eventually, as you level up, this game like kind of promises that it's open world, but it's not really. It's fairly linear. There are these fixed sort of missions, and you open up into sort of mini open areas, which you have to complete before you can move on to the next. And I basically played, I feel like I played a decent amount, maybe like 6 or 7 hours of it. And I just completed my first real mission after a bunch of tutorial. And I gain a new traversal ability.
Most Metroidvanias, like those traversal abilities are based on platforming and give you new ways of navigating the space. But if you're already flying wherever you like, how does that express itself here?
Yeah, I mean, I think I asked that question. Is it really a platforming game if you can fly in any direction, which you can eventually in Symphony of the Night? Well, this game lets you start flying in any direction, but there are these environmental hazards. So you gain a new ability eventually called a dash, which is pretty much what you think it is. It lets you quickly move in one direction based on the direction your character is facing. But with the key difference is that it lets you bypass thin barriers. So there's these kind of like vines or really thin, like you can see on the other side. And you cannot pass through them normally. But once you gain the dash ability, you can reach
it's
other
like mist form
new
in
areas.
Castlevania.
Yeah. And additionally, this has a combat effect in that dashing lets you dash through bullets. So you can dash through bullets and you can dash through lasers, which are ironically really, really prevalent in this game. There are lasers everywhere for some reason. And there are like extremely devious levels that have like laser wheels where the lasers are shooting and rotating in various directions. And you might have laser wheel on laser wheel so that they crisscross each other at certain points. And you have to use your dashes at very specific points just to reach across this hazardous area. Even if you have the life points, you have to do things like carry these like little bomb detonators, which are help you destroy these kind of plant barriers that are blocking your way. And if you get hit even once, you drop the bombs. So you have to make it through all of these obstacles perfectly without being touched, which makes you rely on that dash ability quite strongly. So even though you can fly, even though you do not jump, you do have traversal challenges, which is something I really like about this game. And even though I'm not really much of a bullet hell guy, the bullet hell sequences are very contained. They're self-contained. You can attack them in any order. You can also build your character up. You can kind of gain these like one-time armor boosts. So I feel like it lets you approach those bullet hell challenges in a very staged manner. And you can, you know, always buff your character up as well. So that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking similarly in miniature adventures, not to get into that game, but the broad idea of, like, I've never been particularly into to bullet hells and the mastery of those games, but Metroidvanias or, like, more open, like, RPG games will give you a lot more tools, whether it's other tool sets to counter those, the bullet elements, or just leveling up, basically. So you've got a few options there to get good.
Yeah, and I would say that this game doesn't let you infinitely level up, because those leveling up opportunities are based on specific missions that you complete. There's not an infinite number of them, so you can't really cheese the system either. It gives you a little bit of leeway either way. Anyways, I haven't beaten this game, but I've enjoyed what I played so far, and it only is only becoming a richer and richer experience. And it's challenging, but not too challenging that I'm throwing my controller at the wall or throwing my Switch Lite at the wall. Shouldn't do that, because it's got a screen in it. But anyways, I recommend this. It's not a perfect game, but I'm enjoying it compared to the other more traditional Metroidvanias we've been playing recently.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like a different mix on those mechanics.
Yeah, and the artwork looks great.
Excellent.
All right, how about yourself?
A game I've been wanting to talk about for a little while. I finished this a few weeks ago and got distracted by TCTC, so we're not going to talk about this before it fades completely from my memory. That is the board game Cozy Stiggerville. So this is designed by Corey Knizia, was about five different artists, but it's published by Unexpected Games. And this is basically a legacy campaign game, I guess. You've got about 10 missions in which you're placing stickers onto a map board of a town, following various event cards, essentially. So each of those 10 sessions is going to be, you draw 12 cards from a deck, and they're going to give you a little scenario, a new villager is coming to town, or one of these two villagers is going to come to town, which of them are you going to choose? And you can build a house for one or the other. So it's going to be a lot of A, B choices here. But gradually over time, the technology starts ramping up, you get some new buildings that get you some more options. At any given point, you might have like a dozen options for what you might do on your turn, because broadly the structure is you draw a card, you resolve the question on that card, but then you get an action to visit one of the locations in town, and that might be to go and visit one of the people who, like, once you've established their building, you can go visit them, and there might be a little quest chain, it's very much the BioWare. Each time you talk to someone, their interest in you levels up until it's maxed out, basically, right? So, and there is even a romance plot, I will say. There's only one person you can romance, so no choices there, unfortunately. But yeah, it's a really fascinating little game, because, I mean, you're putting these stickers out to the board, you're putting down houses and roads and animals and flowers. None of the positioning of where you put these stickers matters at all. There is no adjacency rules. It's basically a river down the middle of the board. And the one rule is, until you find a way to cross the river, you can only play on one side of the river. And that's basically the only rule. So where you put them is completely up to you. And so it basically leads you to come up with little emergent storytelling, basically, as to where they're going to be, who's going to be neighbors, where are you going to put the animals, are you going to put the farm on the outskirts or down by the river? And it's basically encourages you to role play a little bit lightly there. So it's really lovely little game. Like, the story isn't particularly deep. Like, it's very cartoony. Like, you've got the choice between, you can build a house for friendly McFarmer or evil McGreedy. Like, it's very clear what your options are here. That even, like, I don't know why you'd want to build bring the evil capitalist into your cozy little town, but you can lean into that if you want to and just make a lot of money. So there are different paths to go down. And there are actually two sides of the board, so you could play a second time and see the other choices. The road's not taken there, basically. But, I mean, I think each of those stories are pretty simple and pretty linear. Like I said, there's someone you can romance, and you're going to talk to them, and, like, your options are, do you say I love you, or do you say this was a mistake? Like, it's a pretty clear binary there. There's no gotchas. Like, I think some of these games will try and trick you a little bit. Like, you'll give you A and B, but you don't know which is the good choice. I think Mistwind, which we discussed, did a little bit of that. in which you're never entirely sure. It feels a little arbitrary what the right choice is supposed to be. And here, there's not really any surprises, but there are a lot of threads to pull. Like, you might have half a dozen different villages with their own quest lines and a few different upgrades that you can build. Like, you can build the post office or a library. Which of those you're going to do? And it's like, at any given time, there might be a dozen threads to pull on. And each of those threads do sort of weave together in such a way to create a nice texture. And, I mean, I played this with a couple of friends. We played through the first four missions in one go. And the following week, we just blitzed through it and completed the whole thing in, like, another six sessions in one go. Because we were really invested in this. Like, six grown men just really, really invested in our sticker town and our romance with the farmer. And, like, it's a really lovely little time. And it's not, like, there's no real interaction. You all have a shared pool of resources. But you can easily get into these trends where each player is sort of pulling your town in different directions. Because no matter how many people are playing, you're going to have the same number of turns. Like, if it's you're playing solo, you're going to have 12 turns. If you're playing three people like us, you're going to have, what, four turns each. So the number of turns are split evenly between everyone. So I think we had a really nice sweet spot where we all had enough turns to get something done. But, like, I'm invested in going into the mine and trying to explore and see what I can find there. But my other friend was he was investigating the Illuminati and the history of the town. And the other friend was, like, getting really into the farms and putting animals out into the village. And so we're all pulling it in different directions, like, as if the town has a bit of a mind of its own. And there can be a bit of conflict, like, oh, you spent all the wood. I was planning to use that wood. But just, again, it feels like the town's gotten away from you a little bit. You could cooperate and just all focus on the one thing if you really want to, but I think this really shined when you've got just a nice balance of people all with their own priorities and what threads they want to put on here. So yeah, we found that really compelling. There's a lot of little, like, mini games. Again, no one thing is particularly deep here, but there's enough different things going on. It's like a Where's Wally? Like, if you can find the lucky clover on the board, you get an achievement to upgrade something. If you can find a bird, you get there's little challenges there. There's some decryption puzzles. There's the romance subplot. There's a little bit of push your luck, like fishing mini game. So it's a little bit of everything, just enough to add a lot of flavor and, like, lots of little bits of spice here and there. So yeah, really, really nice little game.
So would you say that this is mostly a story game, or is there a strategy to it?
There is a story. Like, broadly, that's the arc is you've been outcast from your father. Like, your father's quite rich, but you've been living on his coattails too long. He's cast you free to find your own fortune, and you're building up your town with no handouts, basically. And, I mean, the story, like, is largely... There is an overall story. It's largely peppered in now and then. It's largely going to be the individual relationships you build with the town and the emergent storytelling. There is an end game, not to spoil anything, but the game pretty early on gives you, here's some things you might want to focus on. You might want to have six animals in your village. You might want to have seven production symbols on your board. And so there's some goals to work towards, and at the end it will sort of rate you based on how many of those you completed. But not to spoil anything, like, reading through the options, I think they're all pretty satisfying narratively. I think the one that where you don't complete any of the goals, I think might even be the most satisfying narratively. So it's gonna, like, you can get invested in the town rather than the objectives. Like, there is some optimization in the resources that you have, but it's not particularly challenging. It's just, well, I go to the forest, I chop down some wood, and the next turn I use that wood to build a farm. Like, it's not a lot of push and pull there.
It's a board game, cozy game, it sounds like.
Well, I'm curious, like, the analogs to some TTRPGs, like A Quiet Year. Like, there is a subgenre of map-making TTRPGs, and this almost feels like one of those. Like, at the end of the game, you have a living town, and you could tell stories within it. Yeah, it feels like a collaborative storytelling process, basically.
Yeah, it's you create an artifact by the end of the game.
Yeah, it's absolutely an artifact game. Yeah.
Very cool. All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we talk about some dessert?
Yeah, I've got some dessert to talk about. Lots of things I could discuss, but I think what I'm going to talk about is a little movie I watched, which happened to win Best Picture, I think it was, this last year, plus a lot of other awards. That is One Battle After Another. Have you seen this one, Mark?
I don't know what movies were up for the Oscars. I haven't watched any of them, so no, I don't know anything. But please tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I very rarely see a movie that they come out these days. So I've had this on my list for a while. I don't really care about the Oscars, but enough reviewers who I like had listed this as their favorite movie of last year. So this is by Paul Thomas Anderson as the director. It's basically a member of an old sort of resistance group who's sort of gotten old and washed out. He left the group, went underground, and is basically a bit washed up now. But someone from his past has come back for revenge, essentially, and it becomes a thriller of trying to escape that. And it's a really compelling, like, just as a thriller, just constantly this chain of events constantly cascading into each other. That's just endlessly engaging as it flows from one set piece to the next. So that was really compelling. You've got these, like, a lot of compelling side characters there's an introduction from his past where you're seeing anarchic groups basically sabotaging. I mean, basically what we're seeing today is camps of immigrants being rounded up by the government, and this group is trying to free them and sabotage the government, which is I found really compelling. But the movie does eventually get away from, but you do start to see some other forms of resistance. Like, you see Benicio del Toro comes through as like this martial arts instructor who turns out is like running his own underground resistance network, but in a very different, like, very different type of resistance. So that was really fun to see, that those two contrasting sort of modes of resistance. But again, the movie just gets away from that in a way that I didn't find quite as compelling. I would have liked to see it more focus on those broader systematic issues rather than the personal vendettas that it gets towards in the sort of the latter half. But we're still really some really compelling, satisfying action pieces, some great acting. Leonardo DiCaprio is the lead. Again, like, he was good, but like, wasn't the most compelling person in the movie when he's surrounded by a lot of other people of color who have much more interesting stories, I felt. So he's a bit of a cipher just traveling through the center of this movie, but surrounded by much more interesting characters. You've got Sean Penn as the villain, who feels like he's out of a Marvel superhero villain. Like, he feels like Red Skull by the end. it's quite strange because his name is Lockjaw too, which is like a perfect superhero name. But it is a little strange tonally. Like, sometimes it feels like a Coen Brothers farce or like a Wes Anderson with its like deadpan humor. It mostly balances those tones fairly well. But yeah, it's a really compelling ride regardless. I would have liked to see a slightly different focus, but still a fun movie.
Yeah, and some really even good movies, the main character is certainly the least interesting part of an entire movie, so I think that's fine when the supporting cast holds the film up. That's can be a cool thing too.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, I'm going to quickly go through my dessert piece, which is called, it's a manga called Beyond the Clouds. So this is from publisher Kodansha, and the creator's name is Nikke, a pen name, I presume. So Beyond the Clouds is new to me. I just picked it up from the library sight unseen, and it's clearly influenced by some pieces that I've enjoyed in the past, some that you've enjoyed as well. It's reminiscent of Battle Angel Alita or also Laputa Castle in the Sky. The setting is very sort of like steampunk fantasy, but the artwork is very kind of sort of charming and kind of storybook-like, and actually storybooks are a big part of the themes of the story. The main character is like, what's his face from Castle in the Sky? He's just like a young laborer. He's a mechanic, he's a mechanically oriented guy. And one day a girl falls from the sky. And the girl in this case is sort of like an angel type character. So what's his name? Theo, the protagonist, is the male protagonist, is just a human. And Mia is the angel who has like one working wing and one broken wing. And basically Theo helps her by creating a mechanical wing to kind of put her back to pieces. And the two of them are surrounded by some really charming characters. And a lot of them are also sort of like human animal hybrids. So this game is, this book is obviously very sort of fantastical that way. But really, for the most part, very like light in tone, very humorous. Until the main challenge comes in where basically Theo is surprised by Mia's appearance because like winged creatures are sort of like mythical, near mythical. And some people are concerned that, oh, like you better watch out. Like she might get stolen if she gets found out or maybe sold on the black market or something like that. So there are like a sort of darker, more dangerous things happening behind the scenes. And as you would imagine, her sort of her life and safety kind of gets threatened and the other characters come in to aid her. But maybe she's able to defend herself somehow, like some of these stories go. She has perhaps a potentially darker side to herself as well. So I read the first volume. It's very light and quick to read. It is enjoyable, if a little bit predictable. So, you know, I'll wait to see what the future volumes
certainly
have to
sounds
hold.
Pretty familiar so far.
Very, very familiar tropes. But, you know, the artwork is charming enough that on even on that basis, it's pretty strong. It is a woman mangaka, the creator, who, you know, had been known to do more adventure kind of shonen pieces. But there's a kind of like a decent sized kind of interview of her in the back, and she kind of gives her story where she grew up with older brothers and that like she would often lean towards more of like the entertainments, the video games and stories and action comics that they enjoyed more than the kind of like girly comics that are sort of pitched towards girls in Japan, certainly. So it was cool to see that side of her story and her art influences and her art setup was a kind of a fascinating thing to see. So yeah, not sure. I think it was good enough, but will it be legendary? Probably not. But you know, sometimes it's just okay to have an enjoyable story to pass the time.
Excellent.
All right. So that's Beyond the Clouds.
Okay, well, if you have any questions on today's games, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can see videos of our episodes that we put up on YouTube every time we put them out. If you want to dig into our older back catalog, most of our earlier episodes are only in audio form. You can catch them on a podcatcher of your choosing. We do this as a labor of love. So we'd love it if you'd send us feedback and those suggestions. You can find me on Blue Sky periodically. My name is markyuasa.bsky.social. And yourself, Daniel?
You can find me also at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the OmniGamers Club account there as well.
Very cool. Just a little heads up that we talked about TCTC a little bit last episode, Vancouver Playtest Group. Someone tells me that we may have some guests in order in a future episode, maybe the next one from that aforementioned group join us. So that'll be something to look forward to as well.
Yes, looking forward to it.
Very cool. All right, Daniel, until next time, I think we should say thanks and have a balanced diet of gaming.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.